Yes. Let's begin. Okay. We are starting this. We are ready to begin. We are starting Sefer Shoftim. There are handouts being passed around, and for the sake of completion and doing this, starting off on the right foot, what I'd like to do is take a few minutes and actually go back to an introduction to Sefer Shoftim, which is really an introduction which we went through at the beginning of Sefer Yoshua as well, although with a somewhat different angle this time around. And that is to understand the place of Sefer Shoftim in the overall context of Tanakh. It's an important exercise to go through at the beginning of the study of any Sefer in Tanakh, to see where it fits into the picture of Tanakh as a whole. I'm a very big believer, as you have come to know and love, that that Tanakh isn't just one chapter and one verse, but that the theme, the context, and the messages of any particular parak in Tanakh are intertwined with the broadest overview of what Tanakh is trying to convey to us, and therefore we do a fair amount of jumping and looking and page turning, and that's part of the study of Tanakh, is to see them all the pieces intertwined. But the structure of Tanakh as a whole is an important exercise, and so I've given you an excerpt from a passage from the Gemara in Baba Batra, which actually we looked at, but it was 2.5 years ago, so time to look at it again. And that is the Gemara that describes the list of all of the books of Tanakh in sequence and who wrote them. And if the Gemara goes out of its way to identify who wrote them, then clearly the question of who wrote each book is significant. And I think there are two books in Tanakh that have a completely different meaning and message when you realize who wrote the book. Shoftim is one of them, and Ruth is the other. Most books in Tanakh are fairly obvious as to who their author is. Sefer Yehoshua is a fairly good bet that Sefer Yehoshua is written by, for the most part, Yehoshua. Sefer Yirmiyahu, for the most part, is written by Yirmiyahu. Similarly with Yeshayahu and Yechezkel, the books of the Nevi'im are fairly straightforward. The books that are less obvious are Melachim, the Book of Kings, Shoftim, where its author is not identified, and especially Shoftim and Melachim, which take place over the period of multiple lifetimes. Yeshua's century takes place in its entirety. Okay. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
This was a big fight.
Don't forget that everything we say in this class is recorded and posted on the internet. Sefer Yoshua takes place over one lifetime. Sefer Shmuel takes place, for the most part, over one lifetime. Sefer Shoftim and Sefer and the books of the Nevi'im are obviously over one lifetime because they're over the lifetime of the Navi. The books of Shoftim and Melachim transcend multiple lifetimes because they're approximately 400 years each, chronologically. And therefore, it's even more significant to understand exactly who wrote each book and what their message, therefore, is. Obviously, when a Navi writes a Sefer in Tanakh, he writes it with a particular message or purpose. And part of our understanding of the book itself will be based on an assumption of the authorship of the book, and therefore what its message is all about. So let's start from the beginning of this Gemara in Baba Batra. The Gemara addresses the question of the order of the books of Tanakh. Tanu Rabbanan, we learned in the following Braita. Sidran Shel Nevi'im, the sequence of the books of Navi, is Yehoshua, Shoftim, Shmuel, Melachim, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, Yeshayahu, Shnemasar. Shnemasar we call Tre'esar, because we call it by its Aramaic name, but it's the same thing. That's the sequence of the books of Navi as they appear in the Gemara. On the bottom you have, on the right-hand side, I've given you the summary chart of this entire Gemara, so you have it charted out for you. Yeshua, Shoftim, Shmuel, Malachim, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, Yeshayahu, Tre'esar. Immediately things that we notice are that the sequence of Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, and Yeshayahu is different from the way we have the sequence in our Tanakhs. In our Tanakh, which is the second column, the sequence is Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel. The sequence in the Gemara is Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, Yeshayahu. I put that in bold, actually, so you could see, so that you'd see that more obviously. The Gemara immediately addresses the question of the sequence of the Nevi'im. Now, if you go back to the Gemara at the top of the page, I've given you a little bit of a cue as to how to structure this Gemara. I've put in bold the parts of the Braita. I've put in regular font the Gemara's discussion of the Braita, which is interspersed into the Braita itself. So it's a little bit hard to see, but the bold and the regular font will help you make that distinction. So the quote from this tradition is that this is the sequence of Nevi'im, and then the Gemara addresses it. Michte, let's take a look at this. Yeshayahu kodem Yirmiyahu v'Yechezkel. Sequentially, chronologically, Yeshayahu comes first. Why is Yeshayahu not the first in this sequence? Liktem el Yeshayahu bereisha. Let's put Yeshayahu first. To which the Gemara answers, Kivan de Melachim sofei churbana, v'Yirmiyahu kulei churbana, v'Yechezkel reishei churbana v'seifei nechemta, v'Yeshayahu kulei nechemta, which in another language means that since Melachim ends with the destruction, Yirmiyahu in its entirety is all about the destruction. Yechezkel starts with the destruction and ends with the vision of the redemption to come. Yeshayahu is all about redemption to come. Therefore, we sequenced the books of Tanakh, placing them in juxtaposition by theme. Korban, the destruction at the end of Malachim, leading to Yirmiyahu, which talks about the destruction, leading to Yechezkel, which transitions us from destruction to redemption, to Yeshayahu, which is all about redemption. Even though they're talking about different destructions and different redemptions in different periods of time. But thematically, it takes us, if I look at the whole picture, it takes us in a kind of a mega view from destruction to redemption. And therefore the sequence was Melachim, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, Yeshayahu. Our sequence of Tanakh obviously put it back into chronological sequence. There's a great deal of discussion amongst the commentaries, not relevant for our purposes, at to what point did that transition take place. Clearly the Gemara had a different sequence of Tanakh than we have it. What point in time did that shift back? But it's clearly early because the Tanakh as it appears in all the printed Tanakhim from the days of the early prints and even the manuscripts have it in the sequence that we have. So at some point or another, very early post-Talmud, it was shifted. Second paragraph in bold, Sidran Shel Ketuvim, Rut, the Sefer Tehillim, Ve'iyov, U'mishlei, Kohelet, Shir HaShirim, Kinot, which is what the Gemara calls Echa, Daniel, Megillat Esther, Ezra, Divrei HaYamim. Okay? What stands out there? Want to compare it to the sequence of Tanakh as we have it on the left bottom chart, left two columns. You have the third column is the Gemara's list, as we just read it, and the fourth column is our list in our Tanakhs. It's totally mixed up. Good luck making any heads or tails out of that one, right? It's completely mixed up. So the question now is twofold. Number one, what was the logic of the Gemara's sequence, and what's the logic of our sequence? And here, the process reverses itself. The Gemara's sequence, let's see if we can figure out the Gemara's sequence. Rut, Tehillim, Iyov, Mishle, Kohelet, Shirashirim, Echad, Daniel, Megillat, Esther, Ezra, Divrei Hayamim. Let's work just off the Gemara's sequence. What is the logic there?
You tell me.
Let's figure it out. Are we guessing, or are we working off, I just need to know if we're working off evidence or guessing?
Guessing.
Well, let's see if we can work off evidence. Right, take Eov out of the picture because nobody knows when Eov lived. Eov is ahistorical. There's no historical context in the book of Eov. So we have, and the Gemara will address that question as to when Eov lived, and there's multiple opinions. Leave Eov out of the picture and work off the rest of the sequence. Shlomo is after David, and Shlomo writes Mishle, Kohelet, and Shirashirim. Echa. Which puts us into the time period of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, the end of Sefer Malachim. Daniel? Babylonian exile. Esther? Persian exile. Ezra? Return. Divrei Hayamim? Divrei Hayamim is an overview, but Divrei Hayamim, unlike Malachim, which ends with the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, and clearly, therefore, was written from the vantage point of somebody who lived through the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, Divrei Hayamim ends with the return from Babylonian exile, so therefore was written from the vantage point of somebody who returned, which Gemara says is Ezra. Right.
So the
small print next to those are the authorship. I haven't gotten to that yet. But the larger print on the right-hand side of that column is the Sefer itself. Oh, why is there no Ezra Nehemiah?
Yeah.
Oh, that's the other observation. Excellent, that's the other observation. The Gemara doesn't have a book called Nehemiah. The Gemara only has a book called Ezra. Why? As I've told you before. Why? Because Ezra Nehemiah is one book. In the sequence of the 24 books of Tanakh, Ezra Nehemiah is one book. It was never divided. The same, similarly, the books of Malachim and Shmuel and Divrei Hayamim are one book each. There is no Jewish tradition splitting them into Malachim Aleph, Malachim Bet, Shmuel Aleph, Shmuel Bet, Divrei Hayamim Aleph, Divrei Hayamim Bet. That division, as is the division of Ezra into two books, Ezra and Nehemiah, is a division that was introduced when they divided the Bible into chapters, which was done by the Christians. It's not of Jewish origin. So all of the Jewish traditions will talk about the books of Shmuel or Malachim or Ezra, not Ezra and Nehemiah as two separate books, but they are what we would call the books of Ezra and Nehemiah together. But Uthi, I think, is correct. The sequence here is chronological, starting with Rut, which goes back to the birth of, which ends with the birth of David HaMelech, but is really the story of David's great-great-grandmother. Tehillim is written by David, and therefore, for the most part, focuses on the time period of David HaMelech, leaving out Eov because nobody knows when Eov lived. Mishle, Kohelet, Yerushim are written by Shlomo. Kinot is the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, the beginning of Galut Bavel. Daniel Galut Bavel, Esther Galut Paras, which is the heir to the Babylonian exile. Persia conquers Babylon. And ending with Ezra and Nehemiah, the return from Galut, from that exile. So the sequence of the Gemara is actually chronological. And here's the irony. Our sequence of Nevi'im is chronological. And the Gemara insists that the sequence should not be chronological, but rather thematic. The Gemara's sequence of Ketuvim is chronological. And our sequence of Ketuvim is not chronological. Our sequence of Ketuvim is grouped either thematically or by some other context we'll see in a moment, but not chronological. So if some the shift is two shifts. Number one, we have a different sequence than the Gemara. Number two, whereas in our Nevi'im is chronological, the Gemara's was not, our sequence of Ketuvim is thematic, the Gemara's was chronological. There's nothing deep and significant here. I think it's just an interesting observation that to understand the sequence. What's the sequence of Tanakh the way we have it? The way we have it is in the column on the far left, Tehillim, or of Ketuvim specifically, Tehillim, Mishle, Iyov. Those three essentially forming one group. What connects them, besides theme, because Tehillim, Mishle, and Iyov are all connected thematically, in what way? We know enough about them to know philosophical wisdom, correct. They are all three books of philosophical wisdom. Iyov, right, let's say Tehillim. What's the sequence?
Mishle
and then Iyov. All three philosophical wisdom. There's another connection between them. Connected. Right? This is much more subtle, and I would not necessarily expect you to know this, but there is a certain Masoretic tradition that we call Ta'amei Mikra, also known as Trop. We use it to lay in Torah. We use it to lay in Haftorah. It's those little squiggly lines on every word in Tanakh. There is a common structure to every book in Tanakh, vis-a-vis the syntax and structure of these Tamei Mikra, with three exceptions. And those three exceptions are Tehillim, Mishle, and Iyov. Their trop, the names of the symbols, and the syntax of those symbols and the meaning of those symbols are completely different. They essentially have a different trop to them. We don't even know how to sing them because we have no masoret over the melody of those trop. So they have the three together, Iyov, Mishle, Tehillim, have a separate trop than the rest of Tanakh. And they never chant it. Well, they wouldn't be chanted because we wouldn't know what to do with it. We've lost the masoret of what that trop means as far as melody goes. There is still the knowledge of what it means syntactically, although it's not standard. Most people don't know, but that's still with us. Thirdly, these three books are known by an acronym that puts them together. And the acronym is spelled out of the first letters of the name backwards. Namely, Sifrei Emet. You have Mishle Tehillim. Which reflects, of course, the meaning of the books, which are philosophical in nature. So we start with what we call the books of philosophy, Ketuvim, the writings. Tehillim, you have Mishle. Tehillim written by David, Mishle written by Shlomo, and Iyov supposedly post-Shlomo. That sequence, again, big debate as to who Iyov is. Leaving that debate out of the picture, we start Ketuvim with those three. Then we shift to the next group. Shira Shirim Ruth Echa Kohelet Esther. Again, out of sequence of the Gemara. But Shira Shirim Ruth Echa Kohelet and Esther. What is the sequence? What do those five books have in common, and what is the meaning of their sequence? Shira Shirim. The sequence? Shira Shirim, Ruth, Echa, Kohelet, Esther. What do they have in common? They are the Megillot.
They're also in the calendar order.
Thank you very much. They are the five Megillot. And the sequence is the sequence of the Hebrew calendar in the order in which they are read publicly. Starting, of course, with Pesach, Ruth is read on Shavuot, Eich is read on Tisha B'Av, Kohelet, Sukkot, Esther. And if you start with Chodesh Nisan, which is the first month in the year, then the Chagim are in chronological sequence. So the books of the Megillot are printed in Tanakh in a strange order, because this is written by Shlomo Melech. This is much earlier than Shlomo Melech. This is David's grandmother. Echa is the Chorban, Kohelet is back to Shlomo HaMelech, and Esther is Galut Bavel. They're certainly not in chronological order. They are, however, in the sequence in which they are read in Tanakh, which gives us some indication that the time frame by which the order of Tanakh was changed had to be sometime after the introduction of the custom to read the Megillot throughout the year in each one of the Chagim, which is a later custom. And finally, we end with the last books of Tanakh, which are Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Divrei Hayamim, all three of which are essentially books of Daniel, the exile to Babylon, Ezra, Nehemiah, return, and Divrei Hayamim, which was written by Ezra as well. So those were called Galut, the books of Galut Bavel v'Shivat Zion, the exile and the return from Babel. Add to them three more books that aren't here. Well, they are, but they're not. There are three additional contemporary books to Ezra and Nehemiah, and they are the books of the Nevi'im that accompanied that return. They are Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, and they appear at the end of Tre'esah, because they're Nevi'im. So their works appear at the end of Nevi'im. That's the Gemara's discussion of the sequence of the books. And just to put it together, if you turn the page over, you'll find the complete list of Tanakh as we have it today. 24 books of Tanakh, of course, with the combination of Shmuel Aleph and Bet, Lachem Aleph and Bet, Divrei Hayamim Aleph and Bet, Ezra, Nehemiah together. And then the list of all the 12 books of Tre'esar I've spelled out for you as well. They're considered one book in the scrolls of the 24 scrolls of Tanakh. Going back to the first page again, let's move on to part two, which is, for our purposes, much more important, and that is Mikatvan. Who wrote each book? Who wrote each book of Tanakh? Now, some of them are obvious. Who wrote Chumash? Moshe. And so the Gemara says, Moshe katav sifro, Pashat Bilam ve'iyov. Moshe wrote his book. He wrote Pashat Bilam, which is not part of his book, but part of Bilam's book. Remember, Bilam is taking place separately, parallel to the rest of the story of Chumash. We don't know anything about Bilam. There's no contact between Balak and Bilam and Bnei Yisrael, so that nevuah of Bilam is a completely isolated, separate nevuah outside of the normal sequence of Chumash, and therefore it had to be inserted in later by Moshe. And Sefer Iyov, which again is a big debate as to when Iyov lived and who wrote Iyov, whether he lived under Moshe, whether he was Moshe, whether he was Adam HaRishon, whether he lived later in the time of David and Shlomo. huge debate. The Gemara has all the different opinions as to Eov. I'm not going to get into it. There's even an opinion in the Gemara that says that Eov never happened, that Eov was written as a story, as a parable. Eov lo haya v'lo el mashal haya. Eov never lived, but he was a parable. All kinds of discussions about Eov, we're going to skip it. Yehoshua katav sifro u'shmona psukim shebatorah. Yeshua wrote his book, meaning Sefer Yehoshua, also wrote the last eight psukim of the Torah. According to this tradition, there's a machloket in this Gemara, the Gemara will address it later, who wrote the last eight psukim of the Torah, whether Moshe wrote it or Yehoshua wrote it. Remember the last eight psukim after Moshe's death? That's why it's a question. So did Moshe write it with a prophetically with a tear in his eye, the Gemara says, or did Yehoshua write? Debate, not our issue. Third line. Shmuel katav sifro v'shoftim v'rut. Three books of Shmuel Hanavi are Shmuel, at least up until Shmuel's own death, which is the end of Sefer Shmuel Aleph. The Gemara later will say that the book of Shmuel was completed by the subsequent two Nevi'im that lived contemporary to David, and they are Natan and God. Natan and God. So Shmuel actually has three authors. A whole different discussion. But he also wrote Rut and Shoftim. The fact that Shmuel is the author of Sefer Shoftim is enormously important for us. And at the end of this discussion, we're going to start a little bit on the structure of Sefer Shoftim. I will show you why it's so significant that the book is written by Shmuel. Quickly, I just want to run through the rest of it so you have a sense of the whole picture. David katav Sefer Tehillim ayidei asara zkenim. David wrote Tehillim together with 10 elders. Who are the 10 elders? Meaning not 10 contemporary elders, but there are other authors to Tehillim besides David. He collects the Tehillim, he writes many of them, maybe the majority of them, but there are certainly other authors to the books of Tehillim. How do I know? How does the Gemara know, besides just tradition? Tefillah LeMoshe. Right. Stands to be written by Moshe. What else? Mizmor LaAsaf. Mizmor LeEman. Mizmor LiDotan. LaMnatzeach, etc. There are all kinds of Tehillim that begin usually with the name of the author of that perek of Tehillim. Not all of them are Mizmor LeDavid. Or LeDavid Mizmor. Or LaMnatzeach LeDavid Mizmor. Some of them are, in fact, of Mizmor Shir Livnei Korach, Mizmor LaAsaf, Heman, Yudotan. There's traditions about Avram Avinu writing some of them, Malki Tzedek, Adam Arisha. 10 elders identified through the names of the various components of Sefer Tehillim. But David HaMelech writes the bulk of them, and therefore we attribute Tehillim to David HaMelech. David HaMelech wrote Tehillim, why? Because he liked to sing, because he liked to write poetry, A and C, all of the above, none of the above, right? None of the above. Why did David HaMelech write Tehillim? Or collect Tehillim? No. Because it's part of his preparation for the building of the Beit HaMikdash. Tehillim served the function of being the tefillot that accompanied the daily avoda in the Beit HaMikdash. And David, who wanted to build the Beit HaMikdash but couldn't, lays the groundwork for all the preparation for the Beit HaMikdash, including raising the money, including raising collecting the material, including the architectural design plans, although Shlomo changes them, but including the architectural design plans, which he gives to David. Gives to Shlomo. Almost as if it was David's message that nobody should accuse him of not having built the Beit HaMikdash because he wasn't ready. because he didn't have the material, because he hadn't raised the funds, because he didn't have the prayer books written. Everything's ready. They were ready to go. He couldn't, because God told him he couldn't. But he wanted everything ready. He could hand it to Shlomo and say, okay, Shlomo, now go. And so Tehillim was written much to be the tefillot of the Beit HaMikdash. And they were sung. They were the Levim's role to sing the Mizmorim of Tehillim. Chizkiyahu v'siyato, next paragraph. Yirmiyahu katav sifro v'sefer melachim v'kinot. Yirmiyahu writes three books. His book, namely Sefer Yirmiyahu, Sefer Melachim, Book of Kings, and Kinot, referring to Echa. Now Echa is all about the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. Melachim, the fact that Melachim was written by Yirmiyahu also is an interesting observation, because Melachim, like Shoftim, spans 400 years. So if it has one author, unlike Shmuel, which has three authors, because it's written contemporary to the events, and each author may have a different take on what's going on, or each Navi had a different, lived in a different time period. Here I have a book that spans 400 years of history, but written from the vantage point of one Navi, which means that the message that the Navi wants to convey through the authorship of the book is consistent from beginning to end. That's the difference in a book written by one author and a book written by multiple authors, especially when the Nevi'im. The Nevi'im didn't write history. They wrote a prophetic interpretation of history. So if Melachim was written from the vantage point of Yirmiyahu, what could be its message? If you were to try to guess at the message of Melachim, because it was written by Yirmiyahu, what would you assume that message to be? We know nothing about what's in the book, except how it ends. And I know it's written by Yirmiyahu and Navi. What logical conclusion could you come to about what the purpose of its authorship is? The cause of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, correct. Yirmiyahu, whose whole life focused around the events leading up, the sins leading up to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, which were idolatry primarily, writes Sefer Melachim to chronicle how we went from Malchut David and the building of the Beit HaMikdash, because that's how Melachim begins. It begins with Shlomo HaMelech's construction of the Beit HaMikdash. It ends with Nebuchadnezzar's destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. There's your bracket, there's your theme, there's your connection. Yirmiyahu writes it. It's glaring you in the face. This book was written to tell me why the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed and how idolatry played a role, or sort of chronicles the history of idolatry in the kingdom of Israel. So every event that's described in Sefer Melachim is described from the vantage point of Yirmiyahu's eyeglasses, which are where is idolatry playing a role in this particular story. Open parentheses, that's one of the major differences between Melachim and Divrei Hayam. And one of the exercises that the Mefarshim go through consistently is every time there's a story in Sefer Melachim, they compare it to the story in Divrei Hayam, and they don't always match up. You have events in Sefer Melachim that don't appear in Divrei Hayam, and events in Divrei Hayam that don't appear in Sefer Melachim about the same king. You sometimes even have stories where Sefer Melachim will describe a king as very bad, and in Divrei Hayamim it will describe the king as very good. The classic one in that example is Achav, who is dealt a very harsh critique in Melachim, and given a very, if not parav, almost positive review in Divrei Hayamim. And the Mefarshim struggle with this contradiction. They're both written by Nevi'im, they're both written with the stamp approval of Tanakh, they both have to be true, and yet they can be so glaringly contradictory, and I think the answer resolves itself when you understand that Sefer Melachim is written from the vantage point of a particular issue, and everything is judged in accordance with that issue, namely idolatry as the cause of the Churban. whereas Vayamim was written for a much broader purpose, which was to chronicle the kingdom of Israel, of Judah and Malchut Beit David and its restoration. And therefore it had a very different purpose and focused on different issues. Chizkiyahu, next paragraph. Chizkiyahu v'siyato katvu Yeshayahu mishle shirashirim v'kohelet. Chizkiyahu HaMelech and his Beit Din wrote Yeshayahu mishle shirashirim v'kohelet. Now that's a very complicated statement, because we know that Shirashirim, Kohelet, and Mishle are written by Shlomo. We know that Yeshayahu is written by Yeshayahu. So where is Chizkiyahu HaMelech and his Beit Din playing a role in this story? And there the Gemara explains that they edited these books, that they are books that have a kind of a raw material character to them early, and they go through a redaction or an editing process under the hands of the Beit Din of Chizkiyahu HaMelech, about 150 years or so before the Chumash. So that's the only example here where the author of the book is not given credit for the authorship. The authorship here is given to the editors, not to the author. Interesting. And finally, Anshei Knesset HaGdola Katvu Yechezkel V'Shnemasa Daniel U'Migilat Esther. The men of the Great Assembly, they are credited with the final redaction of the books of Yechezkel, as well as putting together Treyasar, which were each of the Nevi'im, small minor prophets that were put together in one scroll, Daniel and Migilat Esther, which are written during the Babylonian exile. And Ezra katav sifro v'yachas shel divrei hayamim ad lo. Ezra writes the book of Ezra, and the first part of divrei hayamim up to his life. When he dies, the book is completed by Nehemiah. So says the Gemara. So that's the story of who wrote which books in Tanakh, most of which is just general information and interesting tidbits, less relevant for the book of Shoftim. For our purposes, the key to understanding Sefer Shoftim is to know or to understand that it was written by Shmuel Anav. And the reason I say that is because in the same way that when we looked at Malachim and compared it to Divrei Hayamim, I suggested to you that the fact that it was written by one man, by one author, at one time, even though it spans 400 years, is significant because it paints a picture or an interpretation of history through the vantage point of the Navi whose message is trying to convey. That's why it's a book of Navi and not of Ketuvim. That's why it's a book of Navi and not of history. Because it's not a history book, it's a book with a message. And that message is conveyed by the single authorship of the Navi. So part of our challenge in our study of Sefer Shoftim, which spans 400 years, which spans 10 or 12 different major episodes in Jewish history, is to try to find the link that carries the message from the beginning of the Sefer to the end of the Sefer, and that fits in with the worldview of and the prophetic message of Shmuel. That I leave as an open task. As we go through the book, we're going to give you a little bit of the punchline to this issue this morning, but we're going to come back to this question numerous times. Do we, especially given events that can't be interpreted in different ways, our bias will tend to reflect the purpose for which the Sefer was written. Let's I said, I think you see it most keenly in Shoftim and in Malachim, where you have this multiple generation book written by a single person. So let's go back to, let's open now to Sefer Shoftim. The book as a whole is 21 chapters long, which actually makes it shorter than Sefer Yehoshua, but just in terms of chapters. The book as a whole is 21 chapters long, but not today. We will, but Zvat Hashem, finish it. The last two times I taught Shoftim, it took me 3 years. Yeah.
3 years.
Yeah. It took 2.5 to do Yehoshua. Yeah.
We did Yehoshua 2.5 years.
Yeah. What? Not a problem. Why do you think I started Shoftim in a contract renewal year?
It's really funny. Look at everybody's laughing. Is that on tape?
Oh yeah. Sefer Shoftim, which is 21 chapters long, divides very neatly. It's one of the most structured books in Tanakh. It divides very neatly into two parts. Surprise, surprise, so did Sefer Yehoshua. But these two parts, I will tell you what they are now, and we're going to look at them schematically, because I think they fit into this broader question, to the purpose of the book. Chapters 1 through 16 is part 1. Which of course means that part 2 is chapters 17 through 21. All right, very good. Okay. We're on the ball. The question is, why did I divide the book in the transition between chapters 16 and 17? So, the structure of Sefer Shoftim is as follows. The first half of the book essentially follows a pattern that is defined for us already in chapter 2. Chapter 1 is an introduction. We're going to start that introduction today, but we're going to spend a couple of weeks looking at that introduction. It's really an introduction. It's not part of the book. In fact, most of the events of chapter 1 are a recap of the events of Sefer Yehoshua, including the death of Yehoshua. So, for example, the opening line of chapter 1 begins, Vayhi acharei mot Yehoshua, which means this is events that are taking place after the death of Yehoshua. Just in case you're wondering if that's... Take a look in chapter 2, verse 6, Perek Bet Pasuk Vav. Vayishlach Yehoshua et ha'am. Yehoshua sends them home. Somebody asked me a question. How could Yehoshua send them home if he already died? So clearly we've gone back in time. Agreed? Mm-hmm. Clearly we've gone back in time. Not only have we gone back in time, take a look at Pasuk Chet. Vayamot Yehoshua benun eved Hashem ben mea ve'eser shanim ve'yikberu oto begvul nachalato betimnat cheres asher behar Ephraim mitzvon lehar Ga'ash. Yehoshua benun, servant of God, died at 110 years old, buried in his inheritance in Timnat Cheres in Har Ephraim. Those of you who studied Yehoshua with me, does that sound familiar? Those two verses verbatim are the closing verses of Sefer Yehoshua. Which means the beginning of Sefer Shoftim is a recap of Sefer Yehoshua.
So you could skip the...
Well, that recap is important, and we'll come to it as well. But the structure of Sefer Shoftim, from a bird's eye view, is given in chapter 2. And we'll read through that that passage, starting with verse 'Vayasu b'nei Yisrael atera b'nei Hashem v'yavdu ota ba'alim.' Israel did evil in the eyes of God and served the idols of Baal. 'Vayazvu ot Hashem elokei avotam hamotzi otam me'eretz Mitzrayim.' They abandoned God who took them out of Egypt. 'Vayalchu acharei Elohim acherim melohei ha'amim asher sivivotehem v'yishtachavu lehem.' They went and they served other gods of other nations around them, bowing down to them. Vayachisu at Hashem, they angered God. Everybody with me? Vayazvu at Hashem, they abandoned God. Vayavdu l'Baal v'la'ashtarot, and they worshipped Baal and Ashtoret. We will address a little bit later in the course who Baal and who in Ashtoret, and how do they, why do they go together? Vayicharaf Hashem b'Yisrael, God was angry at Israel. Vayitnem b'yad shosim, He gave them over to the hands of enemies as a punishment for their actions. Vayashosu otam, and those enemies, how does it translate? Who's got a translation? Does it translate Vayashosu? Conquered them?
Plundered
them. Plunderers. That's a better term. Vayimkirem biyad oivehem misaviv. He sold them into the hands of their enemies around them. V'lo yachlu od la'amod lifnei oivehem. They could not stand before their enemies. Everywhere they went, God's hand was against them negatively. As God had spoken, as God had promised, if they sinned, He would punish them. And they were greatly distressed. God rose up, or caused to rise up for them, shoftim. We will, at a later time, to address the question of what the word shofet means here, translated loosely as judge, but judge has a judicial characteristic, and the word shofet in this book is less judicial and more military. Leader. So for now, we'll translate it as a leader. Vayoshiyum miyad shose, and he saved them from the hands of their plunderers. Vegam el shoftehem lo shamim, but they did not listen to their shoftim. The shoftim not only were political and military leaders, but they were also spiritual leaders. And the people refused to listen to these shoftim. Kizanu acharei Elohim acherim vayishtachavu lehem. They went after other gods. They served them. Saru meher min haderech asher alchu avotam lishmoa mitzvot Hashem. They abandoned God's path. They abandoned the path of Torah very quickly, not to listen to the mitzvot of God. And here's how it operated. When God would appoint for them a shofet, arise, would designate a shofet, instigate, initiate the emergence of a shofet, Vaya Hashem im hashofet, God would be with the judge, v'hoshiyam miyad oivehem, and He would be successful at leading them in battle against their enemies. Kol yimei hashofet, as long as the shofet lived, He was victorious, and the people were loyal. Ki yinachem Hashem min ha'akatam mipnei lochatzeihem v'dochakeihem, and God had mercy upon them from, and He gave them respite from their anguish and from their oppression. However, v'haya b'mot ha'shofet, when the shofet died, then shortly thereafter, yashuvu v'yishchitu me'avotam lalechet acharei Elohim acharim lovdam lishtachavot lahem. The people would again fall back into their old ways of worshipping other gods and serving them. Lo epilu mima'alu lehem u'midarkam akasha. They left no stone unturned in this effort to be idolatrous. V'yicharaf Hashem v'Yisrael, and God would be angry at Israel. God would be angry at them and say, because they refuse to listen to me, because they have abandoned my covenant, so I will not live up to my half of the bargain. What was my half of the bargain? If they'll listen to me, I'll remove the enemies from amongst the people. From all the nations that Yeshua had yet not conquered, God was going to help remove them from the midst. God says, if they're going to be disloyal to me, I won't live up to my part of the bargain, in order to test them, etc. So So what's the sequence? Israel sins. God punishes them how? Some enemy that comes as a punishment for them. The people cry out, there's great anguish, there's great distress, the result of which is? There is a shofet, appointed, anointed, designated, rising to power, saves them from their enemies, and?
They go back.
And, well, and then the people are loyal for a period of time of the life of the shofet, till the shofet dies, and when the shofet dies, we go back here. This is called the cycle of Sefer Shoftim. It appears in Perek Bet, and it is the theme of every story in the book. What happens from here to chapter 16 are simply examples, one example after another. Othniel ben Knaz, Ehud ben Gera, Devorah and Barak, Yiftach, Shimshon, Gidon, Avimelech, every one of the Shoftim that we are familiar with, stories that have learned to love in our childhood, each one of these stories is an iteration of this cycle. I will tell you now, one of my major themes that we will talk about at length is the fact that I don't believe this is a cycle. I believe very strongly that this is a spiral. A spiral. And the difference between a cycle and a spiral is that in a circle, you end up at the end of the circle exactly where you started. In a spiral, you are spiraling down. Because every time you repeat the iteration, it gets worse. The sin gets worse, the punishment gets worse, the nature of the victory gets worse or smaller. And the magnitude of the leadership gets worse. So we are on a trajectory in Sefer Shoftim that may start here, but that through the cycle is going to take us down to here.
Is there only one shofet at each time?
No, we will talk about that as well. There may be multiple shoftim, it depends on when and where. So we're on this cycle, spiraling downwards. And we can place the Shoftim along this cycle. The last story of the last Shofet in the book of Shoftim is? Who's the last Shofet in the book of Shoftim? Say it louder.
Shimshon.
And just for your information, just before Shimshon is Yiftach. Two very special people. Very complex personalities. That's all part one. And everything, every story of every shofet that we know of is included in these 16 or 15 chapters. By the way, there's only one, there's actually two shoftim that are not mentioned in Sefer Shoftim. And they are? Shmuel is the second. And the first is? But you're much warmer. You're in the right place. Shmuel is the second. Who's the first? Shofet post Sefer Shoftim. That's not in the book of Shoftim. Say it louder. Eli. Eli and Shmuel, whose story is at the beginning of Sefer Shmuel. Now, chapter 17 to 21, take a quick peek. Chapter 17 to 21. Chapter 17 to 21 are two postscript stories to the book. They are not books of Shoftim. They are not written in this cycle that we had before. Every story in this first half fits in exactly this structure. You could take a look at the beginning of every story. The people sinned, description of the sin. God sold them into the hands of the enemies, the description of the enemy. God caused the Shofet to arise, the description of the Shofet. And then what happened? The battle. Every story. Without exception. Till we get to chapter 17. 17, everything changes. We start talking about a man by the name of Micha in the middle of nowhere. He says to his mother, I stole some money. A whole discussion with his mother about having stolen the money. This story has nothing to do with the sequence and cycle that we've described. It's a story called Pesel Micha. It's about the idol that his mother makes out of the gold that she makes and gives it to Micha, and Micha takes this idol and he makes it into a big temple, and he has this wonderful temple going on, and people come and they have, it's like a bed and breakfast temple all mixed in one. People come, he's got people staying at his house all the time, and he's giving them food and he's serving them in this temple, and he's hiring Kohanim. He's got a whole operation over there. In the meantime, Shevet Dan is sitting on the coast. They can't get their land. They weren't able to conquer. So they go looking for new territory. They happen into this house of Micha. They see the idol. They say, oh, this would be great if we could take it with us. They take this idol. They steal it. They go all the way up north into the land of the Bashan, and there, or the Golan Heights, and there they establish the new territory of Shevet Dan. New Dan. That's the story.
Where's the old Dan?
On the coast, in what is today known as Gush Dan, or Tel Aviv, which is called Gush Dan because it was the territorial region of the original tribe of Dan. Story number one. Story number two. Story about, called Gilegesh Begiva. Heard the story, you've read the story, you've been told the story, you skipped it in day school because they don't know how to deal with it, and they don't want to deal with it in the lower grades. Pelegish Begiva is probably the most graphic, horrific story in episodes in Tanakh. And it's about this guy who treats his wife like dirt and ultimately kills her, throws her to the... His wife is Pelegesh, his concubine is harlot, it's not clear who she is. He feeds her to the wolves of the people of Binyamin, and they rape her and they kill her, and he cuts up the body into 12 parts, sends it out to the land of Israel, to each tribe. The people are so devastated, they come, they're going to destroy the tribe of Binyamin for how dare they do this terrible, dastardly thing. And ultimately, it's a civil war of all the tribes against the tribe of Binyamin. They nearly wipe out the tribe of Binyamin, and then... there's some kind of reconciliation with Binyamin, and they have to figure out how to repopulate the tribe. That's the story, in a nutshell. What do either of these stories have to do with Sefer Shoftim? Completely different genre, completely different character. There's no sequence, except maybe the idolatry. There's no sequence of this cycle that's described in the beginning. There's no enemy. There's no shofet.
But there's a theme.
Oh. And the theme is?
They've reached out.
They can't deal with their external enemies. They turn on themselves.
Well, and what if I told you that these two stories took place very early in the historical time period of Sefer Shoftim?
The future of how bad things
are. Right? Which only begs the question of what they're doing at the end of the book. Right? Most Mefarshim agree that these are chronologically out of sequence and that they're actually very early stories in the period of Shoftim, even though they're at the end. So it's hard to describe them as a picture of how far things have gotten when they're very early.
You can turn the theme around. Their disunity, which caused the fighting among the tribes, led to the spiraling when they faced a common enemy.
Maybe. And I think that's certainly part of the message that the story conveys, and the disunity of this. There's a civil war here, although it's not the first or the last, but there's a civil war. There is how they treat each other. There's the idolatry. Those are certainly themes that carry through the whole book, two major themes that carry through the book. From a structural point of view, these two stories are linked. And they're linked with a phrase that I think lies at the key of understanding the book. So if you take a look for a moment in chapter 17, the first five verses of this chapter describe the beginning of the story. Micha is a guy, he steals 1,000 talents of silver from his mother, he admits to it, his mother says, keep the money, she'll make it into an idol, and you can turn the idol into whatever you want. So in Pasuk Hey, he does just that. Ish Micha, lo bet Elohim, this guy Micha, he had a temple, a house of God, he had some sort of temple. Vayas ephod utrafim, he put an ephod in there, some sort of Kohen breastplate type of thing like you have in the temple, in the Mishkan. He had trafim, remember the story of Rachel and the idols of trafim. Vayimaleet yad achad mi banav vehilo l'chohen, he didn't have a Kohen, so he took one of his sons, and he designated him as a Kohen. Vayimim ahem ein melech b'Yisrael, ish hayashar be'inav yasa. Those days there were no king in Israel. And so every man did what he wanted to do in his own eyes. One second. Turn to the beginning of chapter 18. This is almost the middle of the story. The end of the description of the house of Micha's idol, and he finally finds a Levi who's prepared to be his Kohen. Because beforehand he took his son, who's not a Levi at all, made him a Kohen. Now he finds a Levi. And he says, Yonatan ben Gershom is his name. Yonatan ben Menashe is his name. Where is it? It's somewhere. His name is mentioned. Yonatan ben Gershom ben Menashe. Yonatan ben Gershom ben Menashe. Halevi. Sidebar. The Nun in the Menashe is raised, Chazal Darshnit, as Yonatan ben Gershon ben Moshe, Moshe Rabbeinu's grandson. Is this Levi who becomes the Kohen of this guy, Micha's temple. Pasuk Perek Yilchet, Bayamim Ahem, Ein Melech B'Yisrael. In those days, there were no king of Israel. And Shevet Dan went looking for a new territory. Non sequitur, that's how it continues. Chapter 19. Perek Yutet is the beginning of the second story, Pilegesh Begiva. Vayihi bayamim ahem, umelech ein b'Yisrael. In those days, there was no king of Israel. And there was a Levite, and he went to Har Ephraim, etc., and the rest of the story continues. And at the end of the story, skip three chapters till the end of chapter 21, last verse of the book, Bayamim ahem, ein melech b'Yisrael, ish hayashar be'enav yaseh. In those days, there was no king of Israel. Each man did what he wanted to do in his own eyes, or what was right in his own eyes. Four times, twice in each story, beginning and end, the phrase repeats, in those days, there was no king of Israel. Which means, from a textual point of view, there's no question that these two stories somehow, how is not obvious to us right now. We'll explore that in depth when we get there. But somehow these two stories are linked to the theme of Ein Melech. The absence of a Melech. Now some of the Mefarshim, bothered by the question of what does it mean there's no Melech, translate the word Melech here as Shofet. And suggest that what it means is that we've passed in that spiral, we've reached the point where now we don't even have Shoftim. But Navi is very precise. And in all of the book, from the very beginning, the leader is called a Shofet, never a Melech. And at the end of the book, in the last five chapters, four times, there is a mention of the absence of a Melech. And when you add to this picture what I suggested at the beginning, which is that the key to understanding the book is understanding its authorship. who writes Sefer Shoftim? Shmuel HaNavi. And who is the Navi who appoints the first king of Israel, and therefore the transition from the world of the Shofet to the world of the Melech?
Shmuel.
I can't ignore that fact. So, in other words, what I'm suggesting to you is that the spiral described in the first half of the book is then given a rationale, an explanation, a pointing to and saying, okay, we need to fix this. And the fix, if you take a look at this issue, what defined it? Well, here's two stories that defines both the spiral and the problem. And therefore the solution along the lines, remember that he wrote, that Shmuel writes Sefer Shoftim and Megillat Rut, which is the chronicle of David's birth, almost as if they are both designed, and Rut, and Megillat Rut takes place, Vayi Bimei Shvot HaShoftim, in the middle of Sefer Shoftim, to define the background, the philosophical, theological, and ideological background to the beginning of Malchut Yisrael, the need for a Melech.
Isn't there a conflict?
Now I'll get the question.
The conflict is, isn't a conflict, though, that at the same time Shmuel does this in Shoftim, he tells the people, either the king will enslave you, he'll do these bad things to you.
Absolutely.
And so forth, and so you have this dichotomy.
Correct. You have an enormous dichotomy between Shmuel's hesitation, resistance, desire not to appoint a king, and on the other hand, Shmuel's embrace of the king as the solution to the problem of the Shofet, or of the period of the Shoftim. How to reconcile that discrepancy? We will touch upon, to some extent, through our course of study of Sefer Shoftim, and more in depth beginning of Sefer Shmuel. But Chazal understood this dichotomy too, because Chazal talk about the fact that the people, the request for a king is a mitzvah in the Torah. And therefore, the issue isn't whether there should or needs to be a king, the issue is only a question of when. And were they asking for the right reasons? And were they asking for the right in the right time? And is Shmuel opposed to king per se, or is he opposed to the king the way they wanted a king? Ultimately, they get Shaul, not David. So there's some issue. Is that the question you were going to ask?
Yeah, I said I was confused because, I mean, we're learning Shmuel,
right?
And I mean, it seemed to me the people came to Shmuel, but he wasn't excited about doing
correct.
This.
Correct. Chazal are very, analyze that perek in chapter 8 very carefully, because it's, on the one hand, and the Mefarshim are split. Essentially, I would say the majority of Mefarshim assume that that ultimately the mitzvah in the Torah to have a king is a good one, is the right one. And ultimately, when they asked, they must have asked for some reason. There must have been some local, specific issue that meant that Shmuel was unhappy, or the reason for Shmuel being unhappy. It's one approach, which is the Abarbanel, who sort of the anti-monarchist amongst the commentaries. But that's a whole different piece. And we'll have to balance that discrepancy. We will get there. The short of it is that there's no question that at some point we needed what the king represented, or what the concept of a king in biblical terminology. How that ultimately comes to play, and what would be the parameters of the king, and what would be the purpose of the king, could be different given the circumstances in which the king is appointed. And that's one of the major themes of the book, is the fact that the institution of leadership of the Shofet is tribal-based, and therefore reflects the divisions of the tribes. And that only gets worse as time progresses and the tribes grow further and further apart, whereas the concept of a melech is national-based. And therefore there's a sense that the melech can bring the people together, certainly one of the major themes. Okay, so we will stop here. I've done a bird's eye picture of the structure of the Book of Shoftim, specifically from the vantage point of its authorship, giving you a picture of Tanakh and who wrote which books. Bezrat Hashem, next week we will begin.